It's Thursday, January 12th, 2006. You're moving at the speed of creativity with Wesley Fryer, narrowcasting from Lubbock, Texas. Good evening and welcome to my first podcast of 2006, and I certainly cannot claim credit for this podcast because this was an interactive affair, which was actually a Skype cast that involved three other people: Darren Kerpatua, who is in Winnipeg, Canada, Ewan McIntosh, who is in Scotland, and Miguel Gulen, who is in San Antonio, Texas. And we were talking in this Skype cast really about some critical questions concerning Web 2.0. Pretty much in order, we considered the questions of whether enthusiasm in the blogosphere for Web 2.0 is overblown, especially given accountability in the classroom. Secondly, whether there is hope for school reform at a systemic level, both in the United States and elsewhere. And lastly, whether or not schools should repurpose existing educational technology budgets, which right now are largely serving to support a very traditional transmission-based model of instruction. We also touched on some other issues, but we wanted to keep this for under an hour, so without further ado, here is the Skypecast. Well, good evening. It is Thursday, January the 12th in Texas and Canada, and I think it is the morning of Friday, January the 13th in Scotland, and we are having the great pleasure of welcoming several international folks to a Skype cast where we're going to be talking about what kinds of critical questions and issues should we be raising when it comes to Web 2.0. So I'll just go ahead and ask everyone to introduce themselves very briefly. I'm Wes Fryer, and I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and I'm an educator with an elementary background and now at a higher education level at Texas Tech University. Darren, you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Darren Kerpatua. I'm in Winnipeg, Manitoba, right in the middle of Canada, and I teach high school mathematics and at grades 10, 11, and 12.
Okay, great. And Miguel?
Hi, my name is Miguel Gulen. I'm the currently a director of instructional technology for a large urban school district in San Antonio, Texas. This is my first director post. Could be my last as a result of my association with you guys. I've been involved in educational technology ever since I started with Apple IIe's and getting my kids to write and publish.
Great. And Ewan?
Well, I live in Edinburgh on the east coast of Scotland, and I'm really from a secondary background teaching French and German to 11 to 18 year olds, but working as the development officer on a national pilot for our brand new shiny national intranet, which serves 800,000 parents, pupils, and teachers.
Okay. Well, excellent. Well, we really appreciate Ewan getting up early in the morning because it's a little after 4 a.m. there, about 4:20, and it's about 10:20 in the evening here in Texas and Winnipeg, so we're on the same time zone. So let's go ahead and get started. And our goal really is to just explore maybe some issues and questions that haven't been or are not explored very much in the blogosphere and in podcasts, because what we hear a lot is a lot of enthusiasm, really, for Web 2.0, for the potential for it to transform educational environments. And so that's the question that we'll start with that's kind of on our list of possibilities. Is the enthusiasm in the blogosphere for Web 2.0 overblown, since the realities in many of our situations, I think, of accountability in the classroom, of, you know, lots of control from administrators and from school districts and government, really drives education. And actually, I'll ask Miguel maybe to respond to that first, and then we'll just kind of go around the virtual table here.
I don't think Web 2.0 is overblown. I think that for the people that are involved in Web 2.0 and using read-write web tools, it's wonderful to be excited about these tools and what they mean for us. But the reality is that there is another reality, and people are out, school districts, educators really aren't connecting with the read-write web. And I don't think it's just the read-write web. I think it's technology integration, the way we've described it, the way we've sold it and pushed it over the last however many years. And that's really what bothers me about all of these technologies, is that, you know, we're advocating for them. We get so excited about how wonderful they are, and they are wonderful. They are transformative for us. But for the majority of people, they really don't see it. It makes me think of the other side of outsourcing, that video that Thomas Friedman was in, I think through Discovery, in India. And you see how a relatively small part of the population in India, you know, of course over there it's 1 million or 2 million people, are participating in this technology revolution that is threatening to take over the world and flattening the world, etc. And then you go out into the rest of India, where the majority of the population is, and they're still living in poverty and squalor. And that's a good analogy for where we're at in education today. There's a few of us that are doing all these wonderful things, but if we were to walk out our doors, we'll see that it's not having an impact to the rest of the world. Sometimes I think that the read-write web is not here for our students. It's here for us. It's here for us to touch base with each other. And I started thinking about the one of the other questions that you posed about systemic reform, but I'm going to hold off on that now.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and get you as a response on that. What do you think from your Scottish perspective in terms of our enthusiasm? Is it overblown, and what would you say to those comments Miguel's made?
I think the image, the marketing, if you like, for Web 2.0 is overblown, for sure. And I think people who have invented and coined that term tend to do a lot of navel gazing, a kind of, am I Web 2.0 or not? And if they're not, then they feel that they've committed some kind of terrible sin. And I put this question out to quite a lot of people on forum and on the various blogs that I run, and the answers that I got back were, more than often not, they were frustration. Mostly because they feel that the term, for a start, this Web 2.0, even blogging, podcasting, doesn't really reveal what that thing's about. So, I mean, it's true, if I say Web 2.0, what does it mean? And what on earth is a Web 1.0? And if you have to explain something, then straight away you're losing your impact. Whereas the tools that people do use in the classroom at the moment, and that have made a difference, so digital data projectors, PowerPoint, interactive whiteboards, internet websites, hot potatoes, Kia, these authoring tools, email even. These are things that people understand. Email, electronic mail, that's easy enough to get. Websites were quite tricky to get at first for a lot of people, but they use them now, and that's, you know, 10, 15 years on. Interactive whiteboards, it's a whiteboard that's interactive. But blogging and podcasting and web 2.0 refer to things that people don't get. And when they did a survey of British people asking them what blogging was, 46% of them asked the question back, are you sure you don't mean dogging? Which I don't know if you talk about that in America.
Yes, and we won't get into that in detail today, but
no,
that is a miscommunication.
Yeah, it shows that when communication is really the aim of all these technologies, the names we use confound the communication that we're trying to get across, and I think that's why people aren't really grabbing it and running with it. That's a huge reason behind it. And then the other reason comes down to people needing tools, as always, but to be honest, there's always, well, in Scotland at least, there's always money to buy tools. It's just convincing people that they want to spend their money on that and not on another interactive whiteboard.
Right. Well, Darren, what do you think?
Well, you know what, I'm gonna tell you what I think in just a second. Earlier today I posted to my blog about the conversation that we were having tonight, and two people answered me pretty quick, and I thought I'd just share a little bit about what they said, because they answered the five questions as well. In answer to this is the enthusiasm for Web 2.0 overblown, John Pedersen replied, and he said that it is if the conversation continues to drone on about technology. He says that we need other voices in the edge blogger conversation before it gets stale. Accountability won't kill it. We need to match up what we know with good teaching and learning with what we are doing soon. And then Bud Hunt also piped in. He said, is the enthusiasm overblown? No, but it should be tempered with a healthy dose. Now my screen refreshed. It should be tempered with a healthy skepticism. I fell into blogs and blogging because of their potential to help with writing. This other tech stuff has been bonus, but for me, it's all about the three R's. Always has been. Blogs are a tool that can push reading and writing in new and meaningful ways. They're both skills that students need a big handle on. Add the problem-solving and inquiry-based perspectives that so often accompany good blogging. Now you've got math in the mix. The method is new and creative and innovative. The skills aren't. They should translate well into the tests, a let's get the tests out of the way so that we can get back to the cool stuff sort of learning when it's done properly. For me, in answer to the question, it was kind of based on the issue of accountability. And I think accountability turns on the performance, like how kids are doing in school. Our jobs as educators is primarily to teach. So is the enthusiasm for Web 2.0 overblown, given the fact that we have to deal with the accountability-driven classroom? I'd say that they've got the question backwards. I said, no, it's not overblown, because if you look at what teachers are doing with the read-write tools that are available on the web now, look at what the kids are doing with those tools. Look at Clarence Fisher's classroom. Look at, there's so many elementary classrooms lately that I've seen, I don't remember everyone's name, that are doing some incredible stuff with podcasting and blogs. The kids are learning very deeply. If I use my own classes as an example, I think there's no question that if you go visit any one of my blogs, that my students are learning math, and some of them are learning it better and more than they ever have before. In a workshop that I did, I had asked my students to answer the question, what would you do if your blog was gone? And the students' answers to that question was, one of them said, if I didn't have a blog, I wouldn't be passing math.
Wow.
Like a student, it was for a workshop for other teachers that were interested in learning this technology. And one of the students actually specifically addressed one of the teachers that she knew would be in the workshop and said, Mr. So-and-so, if you're reading this, get yourself a blog, because I'm going to be in your class next semester and I need it to survive.
Wow.
See, when I read your niece's blog in maths, I left a comment saying that if I had had my own math blog when I was studying maths, I wouldn't have stopped it at the earliest possible opportunity.
Yeah,
and the reason I stopped it was that I never saw the point in maths. And I remember getting into trouble when I asked why we were doing a particular exercise. And with modern languages, it's exactly the same. Most kids in the town when I've been teaching are probably not going to have deep and meaningful conversations with Pierre at a coffee shop in Paris. They might do is get some level of enjoyment out of writing their blog posts in French and getting comments back. And if it's for enjoyment or seeing the point, that's where these technologies are powerful.
I think you've really hit the nail on the head, Ewan.
One of the comments
that Miguel made earlier was, and I think we're all pretty close in the way we see this, but Miguel made the comment that the Read White Web is not so much for the students as it is for us, the teachers. And I think that we need to shift that emphasis. The moment, there's more teachers that are involved in learning this technology and getting a handle on it, and we need to shift that and put these tools in the hands of the students. When the four of us connected tonight to begin this conversation, I'm sure the three of you felt the same way I do. There's this excitement in the middle of my belly, and I'm telling you, I'm having so much fun, and we've just begun.
And it's the only reason I got up at 4 o'clock in the morning, because Yeah, but the other thing though is that the teachers sometimes think they need to know the technology inside out and have a degree in computing before they can give it over to the kids. And I have constantly used technology that I've half known how to use and gotten away with it. And that's quite, I think it's quite a risky thing to do, and yet sometimes it doesn't work at all. But the kids are human beings as well, they're not monsters. Well, they can be, but when it comes to these things, they're not monsters. They understand that it might not work, and I think they really appreciate the effort that a teacher makes to make things happen than teachers who shy away from it because they're afraid it might not work.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you were talking earlier, you said that when you talk about Web 2.0 to the population at large, a lot of people say, well, what does that mean? Because they're not even aware that these tools exist.
When you turn it into what it means with, you can talk to huge numbers of people at the same time and they can talk back, then they understand.
Yes. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think that we need to, I guess I'm anticipating one of the later questions, but I think we need to focus a lot of our professional development on, number first, raising awareness, making teachers aware that these tools exist by showing them examples of what people are doing all over the world. I mean, you know, Clarence Fisher's classroom is podcasting with another class in Saskatchewan, another class in Korea, and another class in Australia.
Who is
and
that?
He's in Clarence Fisher is wow. is another Manitoban. He's in the remote northern part of Manitoba, about 700 miles north of Winnipeg. If it wasn't for these types of technologies, Clarence would never be able to establish the connections and the links for his kids that they have made with kids in other areas of Canada, in the US, in Australia, and Korea.
Clarence, in Scotland, some of the most innovative linking and use of internet comes from the island schools, where they don't have a choice unless they can afford the aeroplane to get off the island.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, Clarence calls his blog Remote Access, even from here.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, you know, I mean, and that's what it's all about.
Well, let me chime in, kind of picking up on what Darren said, that, you know, the fact that we're able to do this, okay, and, you know, I don't think any of us have published any books and are, you know, I mean, I'm on my home cable connection, and I'm just here in Lubbock, Texas. This is phenomenal. And so I have kind of a split agenda here, because I've blogged before about Luddites and how we need to not necessarily reject technology, but we need to be critical about it. And there's a lot of people around us who, you know, seem to just kind of take things on faith and not think very critically about maybe decisions that are being made to purchase things, etc. My innate response to this is it may be overblown in the sense that not a lot of people are excited about it, but I don't think it's overblown in terms of the huge change that this means for the spread of ideas and the exchange of ideas in the world. I mean, when we look back and think in history about the printing press being created by Gutenberg and how the printing press was, you know, really pivotal in the whole Reformation because of the spread of ideas and just, you know, how governments, and even today, I've heard that Kim Il-sung's the only person on the internet in North Korea. I mean, I don't know if that's true, but, you know, it really is incredible that we're doing this and that we can have interaction. However, you know, that being said, I don't know what the situations are in Scotland and in Canada, but I'll, for the sake of argument and also because he's right, you know, Miguel's point about there just not being a lot of people doing this and extending that to say the pressure of the classroom. I mean, our former governor is now our president, and I have three children, okay, in school. And
that was a sigh I heard.
Well, you know, I really want educational expectations to improve and student performance to improve, but as a teacher and as a parent and now as someone involved in teacher preparation, I've really seen that our accountability pressure makes teachers change behavior. And you know, maybe that's that can be seen as a positive in some cases, but generally it doesn't make them change behavior in seeking the types of creative, interactive, you know, very, I guess I would call them disruptive uses of technology, where we're doing things like Ewan is talking about with the island schools, or Darren, you're talking about with Clarence Fisher. So, mm-hmm. Miguel, you wanna chime in a little bit more on along those lines, and then maybe we'll move on to the reform question.
Well, when you talk about teachers aren't really jumping into this, when do they have time? And when do I was chatting with one teacher. They have to do two or three Saturdays out of every month to prepare their students for the tests. They go in, they tutor students for half a day so that they can get the kids ready to do well on the test. Now, I know this particular teacher has done very well with her students, and her students have done well on tests. You know, they score 97 or 100%, and the teacher ends up scoring best in the school and in our cluster of schools. But are we really surprised that teachers don't have the passion that others have? I wonder about, you know, Clarence, who's doing all these wonderful things. Darren, you know, a guy by the name of Chris Morris, he was talking about the levels of technology implementation. I know, Wes, you're familiar with the Lodi, but I don't know if the rest of you are familiar with it. But
no.
The Lodi is just a framework for assessing the level of technology implementation. And the target level is to use technology as a tool to identify and solve real-life problems. So if we are working on trying to solve the world's problems here tonight, and we're using technology as a part of that. We came up with a solution as a result of that, and shared it, and evaluated it. We might have achieved level 4. Most teachers in large school districts, I'll just use mine for example, are at level 0 or 1. And according to Chris Morse and his research, he finds that as a result of No Child Left Behind, teachers who didn't make it to level 3, which is using technology at the lower levels of Bloom's taxonomy, knowledge and application, are headed back down the framework of down into the lower levels because they feel like they don't have time, it's not a priority, and when you blog, you're really swimming against the current. When you do all these disruptive things in your classroom, or try to engage students, you're actually swimming against the current. So it takes a lot of energy and enthusiasm. I know that if I were in a classroom, I would be blogging with my kids because I used to teach writing. But there are other teachers who just picked up, are teaching writing, and teaching writing to prompts, and teaching writing to the that will get their kids to pass the test. And they get the job done, but are they really getting the job that needs to be done done? And those are the kinds of things that I wonder. I'm as disappointed with my kids when they come home at the end of the day, just like Wesley is. I ask them what they've done today, and if it's, you know, worksheets or test prep or whatever. And see, Ewan, I guess I am turning into the grumbly world.
Well, that's okay. We've been going about 20 minutes here, and I'm gonna suggest that maybe the question of how we move forward could even be a topic that we would take on in a subsequent Skype cast. But I do want to get to our other questions, and we've talked a lot about the idea of whether this is overblown or not. Let's talk about the idea of systemic school reform. And it's wonderful that we can't just limit ourselves, and we shouldn't, to the United States. We're talking about the world, too. And we're talking about really changing behavior, you know, getting other teachers inspired. And we've already, I guess we're going to touch on how we move forward in this discussion, because we've already had folks suggest, you know, how important it is to highlight innovators and to give people experiences. But let's go back to Ewan and then to Darren on this one. What hope do you think there is for doing this broadly? Because if we look at an adoption chart or graph, you know, we've got the early adopters and those innovators. The bulk of people are in the middle, and there's the laggards. And what hope do we have, I guess, of moving large numbers of teachers into this Web 2.0 environment where we're interacting and we're students are producing information, not just, you know, consuming it and trying to spit it back out of the teacher. So, Ewan, what do you think?
Well, I think I have to answer this. I have to kind of go on to question two a little bit. I'll do that and not apologize for it, because you're talking really about changing the attitudes of not just teachers, but our school system. And one of the critical things to get blogging and podcasting and social software in general is are the principles of formative assessment, and the fact that assessment is part of learning rather than assessment of learning is a much more effective way for students to learn. And so if teachers get those principles, if they understand it, then it's a very small step to using a blog to record work, to using a podcast to communicate with other students, to do peer assessment, for example, or speaking. And the way that that's done has to be done on a national basis. So you're talking about systemic school reform. In Scotland, we've kind of done that, because Assessment for Learning is a program that was run as a pilot, and then was the government ministers decided that every school by 2007 should be applying these principles. And then in terms of ICT, we've got the Scottish Schools Digital Network, which is in its beginning stages. We've just spent about $50 million on a backbone of internet access and internet access for every school in Scotland.
Wow.
And that's I'm working on the pilot project to provide content and show how we can change working practices of teachers by just concentrating on modern languages teachers. And we are having quite a lot of success. We've got about a third of all secondary school teachers signed up to our programme, if you'd like. And on that programme and forum, we can discuss these issues, thrash things out. We can provide information from the horse's mouth. So we have school inspectors saying what they expect from teachers. So it's no longer this kind of, I mean, what we're doing tonight is great, but you've got to have the authoritative figure saying this, and not just someone who is a peer sometimes to push things through quickly. And we've got that. So that's helping to not only change attitudes, but also to bring the communication tools to every pupil and every teacher and every parent, importantly, in the country. There's no group more powerful than the parents. So,
right. So you're saying
we've got a just one more thing. We've got this Scottish Schools Digital Network going to provide certain tools which are going to include safe chat, safe voice over internet protocol, safe video conferencing. I'm working on getting a free blog on a community system, a safe free blog on a community system for every parent, pupil and teacher in Scotland, and it looks like we're hopefully on the track to getting that. I would hope that that would be part of the system, and certainly the people I've spoken to are keen to do that. And when you offer the tools for free, there's no longer the barrier of we don't have the tools.
Right.
So, you know, it's costly and it requires organisation from the top.
But you guys are definitely addressing the issue of tools, and I heard you talk about leadership and that vision piece. Darren, what do you want to chime in here?
Well, is there hope for systemic change? I think the change has to start at the grassroots level. In Winnipeg now, all of our school divisions have pretty much outfitted every single school with all the wiring and all the hardware that we need to access the internet. Now the question has become one of logistics, and it's really become one of pedagogy and teaching and learning, because the mechanics, they're there. My attitudes have been like, I'm starting to do something with my class, and I'm seeing, anecdotally, I'm seeing some incredible results in attitudinal behaviors, and for some students in their marks. It's hard to measure exactly. I haven't done any kind of formal analysis, but I would have to say that my students are doing better because they have access to these tools and they participate with each other as a community.
Do you find that they actually interact with each other more like human beings than the kind of ogres some people think school students can be, because they're using these social tools?
My students have learned You mean like doing the silly things that kids do and being a little bit self-absorbed?
Do you think that they've become better communicators with each other? And I guess what I'm driving at is, do you think they've become more responsible global citizens as a result of using these tools?
It has
absolutely 100%.
The nature of their interaction changed as a result.
Absolutely 100%. One of the things that I talk about with my students on all of the class blogs, it's probably the third post that goes up on every blog, is the guidelines for ethical behavior on the internet. Mm. And in there, I share the fact that, you know, I've discovered my students' blog posts on, you know, in Sweden, all over the world, it gets picked up. Uh-huh. And when students hear that, they're really taken aback and surprised by that, and they had never thought that such things could happen. That's why you get young ladies exposing themselves on webcams, thinking that only the person they're sending it to is going to see the image. It's not true. The other thing that students don't realize is that once something gets published to the internet, it's out there forever. Just tonight, I think I picked up a blog post by John Pedersen that in my RSS feed, that when I went to go look at the actual post, it wasn't there. Well, I think
he deleted that post?
I think so. I think so, but it was in the RSS feed. And I don't think he deleted the post because... I'm sorry. Hold on just a second, guys.
Darren, I want to go on record. John has done that before.
Okay. Has he done it before? Well, I don't think... Like, I think he's working on it. I think we're going to see it again.
That's right.
He's
improving it.
Yeah, I don't think he's taking it offline because he doesn't want people to see about it. It's about the Lower Ed BloggerCon is a conversation
right.
that started over at Will Richardson's, and he's picked up on it. He's getting it organized. So I don't think he took it offline because he didn't want to reveal it. I think he's refining it, but it was there in the RSS feed. Another teacher blogger in my school posted something and accidentally deleted it. Was very frustrated because he didn't want to retype it. You know, he had caught in a certain ambiance in the way he had structured his words. And I said, well, I think we can get it back. Let me pick up your RSS feed. So I unsubscribed to his blog. I subscribed again, and sure enough, there it was in the RSS feed.
Yeah. You see, I talk about the same thing to try and convince the... I don't have trouble convincing kids that it's worthwhile. It's convincing colleagues sometimes. And when you have, we have, the same as you guys as well, I guess,
yeah.
The assessment agenda is overpowering sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
That's another thing that nationally we're just trying to pare down a little bit to make it slightly less overbearing. But when we're doing writing or speaking assessments, the question is, you know, why do I have to do this?
Mm-hmm.
And what's the answer? Because you have to, which is a silly answer. But
yeah, it is.
When you tell them their speaking assessment, it's part of a radio show that's listened to by, and we know that we've got 8,000 listeners to a podcast.
Wow.
All
wow.
of a sudden, the jaws drop, and they think, my God, I'd better put in an effort. And I've never seen a class working so hard. And that was because that was right at the beginning. We were the first schools podcast in Europe, and so we had all the attention, and
right.
so we had lots and lots of listeners. But I completely exploited it, and the result was incredible. And the point as well of you know, allowing kids to be messy, and this is why when you said that posts are deleted, I got slightly Presbyterian about it, because the idea of having, I like the idea of a blog like John's is messy, and I like that because I like to see his thoughts develop.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a shame when the messiness is taken away, because I think that helps people see that we're only human and. Yeah, we make mistakes, and yeah, we're floundering a little bit. And it maybe invites them more to come and flounder with us than having perfect copies, final drafts of everything.
I want to jump in here real quick and say that, you know, I think Darren was talking about the anecdotal things that he's seen happening in his classrooms, and I really think from a higher education standpoint and an academic standpoint, Web 2.0 is going to open up research possibilities that weren't possible before. We're going to need to showcase and really, you know, highlight for others, champion others who are doing things like some of the examples we've talked about. I think about Bob Sprankel in Room 208 in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, academics need to be partnering with these teachers. I mean, we may not have anyone right here in Lubbock, you know, besides the podcast that I'm working with some second graders on, doing anything with podcasting. But that doesn't mean, you know, as a researcher now, I'm limited to just working with people who are in the Lubbock, Texas area. So I think
right.
that we need to have this tie between higher education and those who are engaged in this academic research and publishing area, you know, with the innovators in K-12 to be able to really explore these hypotheses that this impacts student learning, this changes attitudes, this changes performance. And so I want to throw that in. I want to also point out...
Yeah, give me 2 more minutes, because
okay.
John
okay.
actually answered this question as well. He said, in answer to this question, he said, if not us, who? He says, we have the ability to do a lot with our toys if we put them to use. And Bud piped in and said, there must be hope. He says he gets frustrated and impatient with all the waiting. Change will occur, but who needs to change and how long will it take? What I think it takes is it's going to take education. That's what it's all about. And when the kids start asking for the tools from the teachers, then the kids, it's a grassroots thing, the kids push the teachers to begin to develop their skills with using those tools so that they can ask, so that they can use them. As teachers begin to access those tools, then they push their school divisions, and they push them to provide the availability and take away some of the filtering that's done in schools so that students and teachers have access to online learning. Student teachers, you know, we're looking at the future. How is it going to change? I don't think it's going to change politically from the top. I think it's going to change politically from the bottom. As new student teachers, as part of their curriculum and instruction formation, are exposed to, here's the tools, here's how it works. When you go out and you do student teaching, make sure that you access these tools and you incorporate into your learning in a meaningful way that develops your pedagogy. When those things happen, when the student teachers, another generation comes by, and the students begin using these tools and push their teachers, and the teachers push their school divisions, then politically it's going to come from the bottom up.
As of tomorrow at Jordan Hill, which is Scotland's largest teacher education institution, David Muir from EdComplog and myself will be doing a tour lecture to every student, 650 of them,
wow.
about Web 2.0. And
right.
They'll all be listening to this podcast as well, I'm absolutely sure.
Hey, we'll have it online later tonight, so it'll be there.
Fantastic. And the other thing, I'll drop this in, it will take me 15 seconds because I know Wes has got a stop clock for this show. But about 23 years ago, I can hear someone's cat. That's so cute.
That's right. We just got a new kitten.
23 years ago, our family, me and my brother, received the first ZX Spectrum computer, home computer, which we played things like Pong on it, and you had to load things up on audio cassette, and we spent hours on rainy Saturday mornings and doing coding, and there were a lot of rainy Saturday mornings. Well, 23 years later, I'm part of the first generation of teachers who use computers naturally in their teaching, and that's how long that took. And I hate to be depressing, but you know, it is a time factor. And it goes back to the post that I wrote on Time for Wisdom, that you've got to, in every change in the planet, in the history of time, there have always been people who've invented things who have quite often died sad and lonely deaths before anyone took any notice of their work. And we might not die sad and lonely deaths before people get catch on to what we're talking about, but it might take longer than we think.
Okay. Well, we're about 36 minutes into this. I do want to comment, I should have said at the beginning, that we'll be posting links in show notes to the resources, and so I'll just invite each of you, if you don't mind, after we hang up our Skype conversation, to go ahead and send me any links that you remember mentioning, and we can communicate with each other if we forget some. But I want to go ahead and move to question 3, and I'm basically make a state this as a position and then ask you all to respond. We'll go to Miguel, and then we'll go to Ewan and Darren. And the statement is that the reality in schools today is that Web 2.0, and I'll speak for the schools I'm aware of that are here in Texas, Web 2.0 is not making an impact. We are spending literally millions and millions of dollars on technology with this faith that it's going to transform education. And I read Larry Cuban's book, Oversold and Underused, this summer, and he has this thing called the fourfold assumption of educational technology, and I won't go through the whole thing, but basically, you know, the first thing is we buy the technology, and by the time you get to stage 4, it's that we've transformed teaching and learning. And so the point here, which, you know, I see it, and I'm not saying I totally buy into this, but for the purposes of our discussion, I'm going to make it, is to say school districts need to stop wasting their money on all these technology upgrades. I mean, nobody was using all the features of Word 97. Why the heck do we need to transfer to Vista? You know, we're just...
Especially when you have Writely available
well,
for free
yeah.
on the web.
Well, that's true. But this position is basically saying, let's just stop wasting money. You know, good instruction is not, you know, necessarily tied to technology. We need to pay teachers more, and we need to stop, you know, running on this treadmill of upgrades that, you know, some people would say is conspiratorial. Others would say, you know, it's just companies and quarterly profits. But let me get some of your responses to that. And I guess we could extend that to say, if schools are going to spend, are going to have technology, let them have open source technology that's free. Maybe that gets into a little different subject. But we should be doing radically different things with, instead of wasting our money on all these upgrades and things that where people aren't even using them. Because what are they asking kids to do? They're asking them to type, how do I make a hamburger on the computer, you know, instead of writing it? Let's get Miguel's response to that first.
Wes, it doesn't sound like you stated a position. It's like you just made the argument.
Well, right. I'm making that position because we're having a lot of, you know, basically positive here for Web 2.0. I'm trying to, you know, stir the pot here, be a little disruptive.
Well, the problem is I agree with that point of view.
That's fine. That's fine.
we were just having this discussion on technology coordinators list that's through the Texas Computer Education Association, TechSig. We're spending so much money on a variety of proprietary solutions. I shudder to think about how much money is flowing out of a school district. The technology allotment, the state technology allotment, which is per student, was supposed to be $30 per student in Texas, and it's actually $27. And they seem to cut it every year and lower the amount so that we end up with less money than what we would hope for. No Child Left Behind, Title II, Part D, which I'm sure all of you know has been, No Child Left Behind has been cut, especially the technology portion. That money, which some school districts can get quite a bit of funds from, let's say a large urban one that I know of really well, gets around $800,000, $850,000. Well, that money can be redirected by the superintendent and spent in different ways. So the money that we have for technology expenditures, let's say it's $1.6 million in our school district, ends up coming into the district, and then instead of being spent to purchase additional hardware to saturate sort of the classrooms to make sure that we have plenty of access, ends up being spent on purchasing all these proprietary solutions. Especially when you start considering No Child Left Behind and all the assessment solutions that are out there. For example, I don't know if you all have heard of MyAccess, which is a tool that allows you to assess students' writing. Other solutions like integrated learning systems like SuccessMaker, Plato, mm-hmm. Compass Learning, all of these have been around forever and ever. But now that we're starting to realize that technology integration hasn't paid off for us, you know, we've been preaching this, and we're practically preaching to the choir here, but we have been trying to do this for so many years, and superintendents aren't slow on the uptake here. They're looking at what we've done and what we've accomplished, and they know that we only have pockets of excellence. They only know that there's one Ewan McGregor in all of Scotland. They know that there's only one Darren or two in Canada. And these people are scattered throughout everywhere. We are able to connect through the Internet, as you all have said, and sort of feed off each other in our energy. But the fact is that most schools may only have one, at most two people on the campus. Why should we continue to spend so much money bringing all these tools in and providing them just for a select few, even though they're wonderful people, etc.? It's a waste of money. I think we should repurpose our funds and spread them out. I really foresee the end of educational technology as we know it, instructional technology, all of that will go away. We were separated at the beginning, and whether it was a conspiracy or whether it was done with good intent, and we've evolved since then. whoever split us up, whoever took educational technology out of curriculum instruction, killed us right there at the beginning. We should have been left in. It's sort of like imagining bread and yeast. The yeast, we're the yeast, should have been left in there, and we weren't. So those are the kinds of things that I get very excited about, the kinds of things that y'all are talking about. I don't believe that we have systemic reform, and I don't believe in that concept. I've been hearing those words for a long time, ever since I've been a young teacher, dying to do wonderful things.
But we also don't have technology integration. Like, that hasn't happened.
It's a myth.
Technology integration with what, though? Because I think that the most important thing is the teaching and how people teach. And you can't change someone who's been teaching in a certain way for 20 years overnight into teaching in a different way using ICT tools. So, and there's only so much money to go around. So do you concentrate on teaching new teachers in these skills and then wait the 20 years it takes for them to come through the system, by which point their skills are obsolete anyway? Or do you launch the kind of blanket professional development, which is what we're doing in Scotland, that costs a lot of money but leaves less money to spend on tools? And I think that is the right way to go. My biggest problem is that in local authorities, we don't have superintendents. Superintendents run police stations and prisons in Scotland.
Well, they do that here too.
Yeah, exactly. Our version of the superintendent, our biggest problem is that the spending on ICT isn't transparent. We don't really know what's spent, not in every case. And what we've got are, we have pockets of excellence, but normally they are funded through people applying for grants and extra money, sort of winning money. And I'm quite happy with that, really, because there's a lot of money in that pot that you can win. So you can have a pocket of excellence without feeling guilty about it, and help the general population, as it were.
Darren, what do you think?
I think Miguel was talking about that the technology and the curriculum instruction were separated, and that was a mistake, and I think he's right on the money. In order for this to be successful, you need to have the technology driven by the pedagogy and not the other way around. And the attitude that seems to have been adopted in education with regard to integrating technology is, it's been done the other way around. Like, let's stick in all this technology. Was it Miguel who was saying that, you know, we're going to use a word processor to type how to make a hamburger?
Well, yeah, that was me, Wes.
Oh, that was you, Wes. Okay, so, like, that's right. I see a lot of teachers doing stuff like that. Like, they don't need to use a, you know, $1,000 typewriter to say, here's how you build a hamburger. It's not necessary. That's not technology integration. But for a lot of people, if I'm writing my paper on a word processor, that's technology integration. It's not. When Web 2.0, or maybe it's better described like Will Richardson calls it, the read-write web, because it has that interactive dynamic, that is more along the lines of integrating technology into the pedagogy. When you have a meaningful interaction that leads to students learning, that is an important learning experience, and to the degree that technology fosters those learning experiences, they are both powerful tools and educational technology.
You're spot on.
Okay, well, I want to give everyone a chance to basically do a wrap-up comment. We've been going here for about 47 minutes. I'll go first and have a really self-serving initial comment, and then one other insight on something that Ewan said towards the beginning.
Wes.
Okay. Are we better now?
Hear you again. Yeah.
Okay. We'll do some editing and edit that out.
Oh, great.
The first thing I want to say is that we clearly are ahead of the curve in terms of the awareness in the general population about this. And Ewan talked about the need to kind of go to lowest common denominators for some things, like emails. And I'm in a discussion right now with people about our site conference, which is coming up in Orlando in March, and the dialogue is basically being done with email because that's what people are most comfortable with. I really think we need to be giving people experiences using these tools. That's what teachers need to do in professional development so that they can experience it and see, you know, what it can do so that they'll utilize that with their students. And that's really the bottom line. And that's what I'm passionate about trying to do at a higher education level. I mean, I am looking for a tenure-track faculty position for the fall, and that's what I hope to be doing, you know, in the future, is working with schools and working with teachers and folks that want to become teachers in providing these kinds of experiences, exactly what we've talked about tonight, sending those student teachers into the field so they can use these tools and help educate from the grassroots up. So that's my my last comment. Ewan, what would you like to say?
I'd just like to say that, I mean, I think also my point is not to go to the common lowest denominator, actually the opposite of what I believe in. I think you've got to use the tools and give people a reason to use them. And normally those reasons come straight at you. You don't need to, it doesn't need to be contrived, it doesn't need so much thinking going on behind it. The best example being a group that we put together to manage the ICT strategy for a local authority in Scotland, the East Lothian Council, where I come from teaching-wise. At the end of the day, we hadn't managed to discuss everything, so the immediate reaction was, we've got to set up a wiki, and then we can continue changing each other and chipping in, adding our own thoughts as we want to, and we can do that for a month. And everyone immediately went, yeah, that sounds great, let's do it. Yet many of them have never used a wiki before. I just wanted to clarify that.
And let me just say, I agree with you. The conversation we're having is how to leverage Web 2.0 tools at a conference. But the irony is, the folks we've talked with are saying, let's just use email to talk about this because that's what everyone's comfortable with. And that's just kind of an irony, and I agree with you. We need to use the tools so that we educate people through that experience about what their potential is.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing is, as well, though, is it's kind of chicken and egg. Do you have to teach people hands-on how to use these tools first before you can have a conference about them? And if you're having a conference about them, are you going to exclude people who might have something interesting to contribute in terms of the pedagogy, but you're excluding them because they don't know how to use the technical bit of the tool?
Right. Darren?
I prefer to have the wider group of people contributing to the discussion than to exclude people through them not understanding what the tool is or just being turned off because of the terminology involved.
Right. Darren, what about some last comments?
I think in order to really... The key is education. So we have some teachers who they know their pedagogy and they know their technology. And those are the real educational technologists. And I think that looking to the future, what we might want to do is establish master teacher mentors that know how to use the technology and are very fluent in the pedagogy and can model what technology integration really looks like. And let's partner them up with interested other teachers that want to pursue those same goals. And then those teachers will acquire those skills naturally because they want them. In terms of designing professional development for other teachers, like for many teachers, they're just not aware. So in the way that the teachers that are incorporating technology and read-write tools in their teaching, if when we're planning our professional developments, when we take leadership roles and run a professional development, and we orchestrate it with the teachers in the same way that we do with the students in our classes, then the teachers, number one, get exposed to the technology, and number two, they have a model for how to apply the technology in a pedagogical context. Some of the people I'm thinking of are people like Alan Levine and Brian Lamb. When those guys do workshops and they write about them on their blogs, I mean, I'm always saying, man, I wish I was at UBC with Brian Lamb, or I was in Arizona with Alan Levine.
Great.
And I think those guys are some of the mentors or models that we have to look to.
If you'll go ahead and
other teachers should take those roles too. Like those of us that are getting involved should, in each of us in our own communities, step up and offer to do the workshop.
And the other thing that I think might be quite exciting is for people in general is that on the Modern Foreign Languages Environment project, of which I'm the development officer. We're running a project with 23 other countries in Europe that's a blogging project in modern languages, with every country you can imagine, from Central Eastern Europe and from Western Europe as well. And we're going to actually put together video footage to kind of run a virtual workshop and put that online, and it won't be closed. Everyone will be able to see that and add their own comments on our own blog and kind of interact with that. So that'll be in March that we'll put that online.
All right, Miguel, let's wrap us up.
Oh, I'll give it a shot. The looking at my, just reflecting on my experiences so far as an educational technologist, I don't believe that putting master teachers in schools and letting them pair up with other teachers is going to have much of an effect. I think that's what we've already tried to do with campus instructional technologists, and unfortunately those people end up doing techie things more than they end up doing curriculum integration. That's why I think we need to take the whole educational technology piece and just throw it away. We need to reintegrate into curriculum and instruction. If I'm a writing teacher who got into technology because I like to be able to publish my work, I need to go back and join the English department and work with them on that, and focused on the key, which is communication, facilitating communication between people. That's what the technology is all about. That's what the technology, that's the technology part that gets people excited, and being able to share ideas. Ewan, when you're talking about the video pieces, creating the wikis, anything that fosters communication, facilitates the collaboration between different people, helps you build put a solution together that's going to meet the needs of all the stakeholders. That's what technology use is about. I always worry that we've lost the meaning of and the power of the technologies that captivated us. I go back to why I got involved in technology, and it was because I wanted to be able to publish. It's the Gutenberg Press, as Wes said early on. We want to be able to get our ideas out there. So I'm don't want us to fall back into what has already been tried, campus instructional technologists, putting technology experts everywhere. We need to move ahead with a new model, a different approach, and we need to forget about systemic reform as it comes down from politicians and everybody else. The real changes are the ones that are taking place in our classrooms, and in your classrooms, really. As my role as a director of IT is really to shine the spotlight on you and try to facilitate more of those situations. And that's how reform will come about. I don't think we have to wait 20 years. People will get excited. If we can capture that, what got teachers into education and allow them to share ideas, I think that they will be beating down our door to do these things.
Well, we've had a lot of good ideas and good suggestions. What I'm hearing Miguel say here at the end is similar to David Warlick, who talks about redefining literacy for the 21st century, and it's really not about talking technology, it's about talking about teaching and learning, but using these tools as ways to prepare students for literacy, which is a much more expansive term than what we would traditionally think of. So I want to thank everyone for joining us, and we've actually managed to stick with our approximate hour goal, and hopefully this won't be the last time that we'll get together and do this, because I can't tell you how exciting it is to be here in Lubbock, Texas, and talking with Ewan in Scotland, and Darren in Winnipeg, and Miguel in San Antonio all at the same time, and it's all for free over the internet, so it's just incredible.
That's right.
So
thank you, Wes.
All right.
Thank
well,
you, Wes, for organizing this as well.
Thank you, guys.
Well, I'd like to again express my appreciation to you and Darren and Miguel for their participation, and we hope to have another one of these before too long. Also, thanks to Alexander, my now 8-year-old son, who at age 7 composed music used in tonight's podcast. Please join me again for another Moving at the Speed of Creativity podcast, which you can find online at www.speedofcreativity.org.